We are continuing this morning with our study that we just began last week through the book of Job. So today we'll be looking at Job chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, if you would like to turn there. Let me mention, too, we're listening and taking into consideration a number, some of the comments about the hymn book that we're considering, and we're still considering. So we're going to hold off a little bit on actually ordering those until we consider, what some different options are. But I'll just take that for now because there's no decision. We're just, I just say we're listening. You know, we've heard some of the things that you've mentioned. In chapter 1 last week, we were introduced to Job in the very first verse as being a man who was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. God confirmed that description himself in verse 8 as well. So it's clear from the beginning here that it's making clear to us that Job is definitely a godly man. He's also a man who's been greatly blessed by God. He has 10 children. He has many sheep, oxen, donkeys, camels. He has a great many servants. He's also considered, as it says there in verse 3, the greatest of all the men of the East. He's been greatly blessed. We also saw last week that there came a point where Satan came before God. God called Satan's attention to Job. And Satan says, well, the reason Job is such a godly man is because you've put this hedge around him so that nothing bad can happen to him. And of course he serves you. I mean, you give him all this stuff. Of course he serves you. Who wouldn't? If he were to lose all those blessings, then he would curse you to your face, what Satan says. Now, Job was clearly in the hand of God. God chose to give Job over into Satan's hand. But as we said last week, he still kept his hand on Job. He gave Job into Satan's hand, into his power, is what the scripture, the way it word says there, which is literally hand. But actually, he's still in God's hand as well. He's not outside of the hand of God. So he was still there. And God, even though he gives Job over, he gives very specific instructions to Satan on what he can and cannot do. So there's limitations there. He's still in the hand of God. Satan takes this opportunity and brings four major trials into Job's life in quick succession. All of his livestock are destroyed or stolen. Nearly all of his servants are taken or killed. And worst of all 10 of his children are killed at the same time. Job's response to these things is quite remarkable. We'll read it again. It's in chapter 1, verse 20 to 22. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. So, four things we mentioned that Job did in those verses. First, he grieves over his loss. Second, he humbled himself under the sovereign hand of God, recognized that God was sovereign over him and over all of his circumstances. Third, he recognized that the blessings in his life were given by God, but they are also taken away by God when God deemed that that was appropriate and proper. And then fourthly, Job continued to worship, and he showed just absolute trust in the character of God, that he could continue to trust God regardless of how the circumstances were at the time. Well, now picking up in chapter 2, we're reading about how Job's second test came about. That was the first test. Now we read about how his second test came about. So let's look at verses 1 through 10. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God, and turning away from evil." and he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your power, only spare his life. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Now, there's basically two main things that we see here. We're going to divide up into two main categories. First off, we see Satan continuing to try to get Job to curse God. And we'll talk about how that happened. And then secondly, we see how Job responds to this second test. So that's just simply how we'll look at it this morning. Your first point then is this. Satan continues to accuse Job before God, even though he has failed to shake Job's faith. Now, once again, if you just kind of look back over those first three verses of chapter 2, we see a lot of similarities to what we saw in chapter 1. Once again, Satan has to give an account to God for what he's been doing. Once again, God brings up his servant Job and to Satan. Once again, the Lord affirms that Job is blameless, upright, fearing God, and turns from evil. It's like Yogi Berra said, it's like deja vu all over again. But then God actually adds something to this one. Here he adds, he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. So we see here this next point. In spite of the severe trials that Job has endured, he has not only maintained a right relationship with God, but has actually grown in his faith. God starts off with the exact same description of Job as a godly man. But of course, at this point, this is after Satan has done everything within his power to try to provoke Job to curse him. Brought those four disastrous trials into his life. It's overwhelming. And of course, then instead of cursing God, Job says, blessed be the name of the Lord. So Satan was wrong. It wasn't the material blessings that Job had that was the reason that he was faithful to God. It was because he was committed to God and believed him and trusted in him, regardless of the blessings. So taking away the material blessings did not make Job deny his faith. Taking away his children did not cause him to turn his back on God. He continued to express faith. He didn't understand why everything was happening. It's important for us to remember that. There was lots he didn't understand. But he knew he could trust God, even though he didn't understand what was taking place around him. But like I said, as a result of coming through this trial, God adds the fact, that phrase, Job still holds fast his integrity. So Job did not go backward in his faith. I think you could probably say he didn't just kind of maintain. He actually grew in his faith as a result of these trials. Because he's stronger. I mean, it says now he holds fast his integrity. He was holding fast his integrity when everything was going well. The blessings. Now he's holding fast his integrity in hard times. In really, really hard times. He's still holding fast his faith. Holding on to his integrity. So that's growth. That's strength. That's maturity. He's strengthening, which is the opposite of what Satan was intending to take place. So Job's faith is stronger as a result of going through the trial. Obviously, that's not what Satan intended, but it is what God intended. And it kind of reminds me here of a passage I want to bring your attention to over in the New Testament in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. It's the passage where Paul was talking about the thorn in the flesh that he had. And it's very interesting how this is described. I'm going to read 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10. Paul says, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations that have been given to him, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I implored the Lord three times that it might leave me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weakness, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Now, notice back at the beginning there when Paul's talking about the thorn. And it says it was given him. There were two purposes for the thorn. There was God's purpose and there was Satan's purpose. God's purpose, in part, he says, was to keep him from exalting himself. And it gets more, that gets more specific as he continues on, is for him to recognize that even in his weakness, the power of Christ is perfected in him. So Christ is exalted, not Paul being exalted. That was God's purpose, and God's purpose prevailed. Satan's purpose was, the thorn is called a messenger of Satan to torment him. Satan's purpose was to torment him, to make life hard for him, to make it worse for him. They had two different reasons in the same thing, and it's called, once again, a messenger of Satan. So Satan had a purpose, God had a purpose, God's purpose won out. Actually, this was a great revelation in itself to Paul in his own life. He more gladly began to boast about his weaknesses so the power of Christ would be more evident in his life. Well, when you go back to Job, it's the same basic idea here. Satan had a purpose in the trials that came in Job's life. God had a purpose as well. God's purpose prevailed. Job actually got stronger in his integrity. He held more firmly to his integrity by going through the hard things, whereas Satan was trying to get him to curse God. Two purposes, same trial, same event. That's an important lesson for us to learn. Because in our trials, you can make that same connection. When Satan throws a temptation at you, or when a trial comes into your life, whatever it may be, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, whether it's material, whatever it might be, Satan's going to try to use that trial to do you harm in some way. I mean, to somehow weaken your faith in some sense. God intends for your faith to be strengthened in certain ways by the exact same trial. So you need to be aware of that in the things that go on in your life. It's so easy for us to focus on how bad things are, but at the same time, we need to recognize God has a good purpose in this, a good purpose in this. So the same thing applies to us as we think about the things that we deal with. Now, another thing that we see emphasized in these verses is this. There is nothing in Job that deserves the suffering he has endured. But God allows Satan to continue to test Job by afflicting him physically. But even though Satan is the one who brings Job's afflictions, God is the one who sends them. Satan is the one who brings them. He's the messenger, so to speak. But God is the one who sends them his way. Now, it's important for us to take note of the fact that the trials, several things here I want to bring all into the same point. The trials that Job is enduring are not given to him to punish him for something he's done wrong. I mean, this book has gone out of its way to emphasize the fact from the very first verse, Job is blameless, man of integrity, fears God, turns away from evil. God reinforces that whenever Satan first is in the presence of God that we see in chapter 1. And the second time, God reinforces it again. This is after the fact of the trials, and like I said, even as of the fact that he's holding fast his integrity. So it's clear, I mean, it's clear that Job is not being punished for something he did wrong. The things that are happening in his life are not to chastise him in some way. They're not to punish him. Another thing that we see is and actually kind of tying into that, in that verse 3, God says to Satan, you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Once again, you see that same emphasis there. To ruin him without cause. There's not a cause in Job for these things that are happening as far as, you know, him being punished in some way for that. He had done nothing to deserve that. But second, when God says, you incited me against him, it's probably good to just say a few words about that. That doesn't mean that Satan's in charge. You know, Satan incited me, so I had to do what Satan said. I mean, it's not like, this isn't saying that Satan's in charge. It doesn't mean that it was all Satan's idea. It doesn't mean that God allowed these things to happen against his will. I mean, the whole conversation, the way it's done, shows that Satan is the one who is accountable and under the authority, so to speak, of God. He has to give an account to God for what he's done. If you remember, God's the one who brought up Job to Satan. And Satan then comes back with his accusations. This was something that God intended to take place before Satan even brought it up. But Satan is the one who brings it up. And so the sense here is not to say that somehow Satan had got an upper hand and kind of tricked God in some way. There was nothing like that. God was in charge of the whole situation from beginning to end. But it is a reminder to him. You incited me against him without, you know, you incited me. By the way, it didn't work. You notice he's just as faithful as he ever was. It didn't work. But you incited me against him without cause. The other thing to notice here in verse 3, God says, you incited me against him. So who is against Job? God says it's God. You incited me against him. Like I said, Satan is the messenger. He's the one who brings the affliction. But God is the one who sent them. You incited me. This is God saying this. You incited me against him. This is consistent back with what Job said back in chapter 1, verse 21. The Lord gave, the Lord took away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So even though Job knew nothing of these conversations between Satan and God, he understood that God was sovereign over all things. And he knew that nothing could come into his life that God did not ultimately bring himself, or at least send. Like we said last week, that's another application for us. I believe it's absolutely vital that as things come into our life that are hard and challenging, that we have to keep this same mindset of that God is sovereign over our trials. He is sovereign over our trials. It's not somehow that Satan got in and kind of God wasn't looking and he brought this stuff in. It's like, man, where did this come from? This is all of the devil. And I mean, we have to recognize that if you're a Christian, you are always in the hand of God, no matter what your circumstance is. You're always in the hand of God. And that will help you tremendously in walking through the situation that you're in. If that's not there, you're going to have a hard time holding on to faith. Let's move on a little bit. Look at verses 4 through 6. Continuing the conversation, Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life. Basically, Satan says now, you wouldn't let me harm Job physically the first time, but if you'll let me afflict his body this time, then he will surely curse you to his face, to your face. Now, the phrase skin for skin, Satan starts skin for skin, and then he goes on and says, you know, he wants to torment Job physically, bone and flesh. Skin for skin is an interesting phrase there, and there's different ideas on what that means. Some would say it's kind of like a reference. Skin, it's obviously a reference to life, basically. And the idea of the skin of all his livestock is destroyed. The skin of his children is destroyed. now he wants to go after Job's skin, Job's life, Job's, you know, very existence, physical existence. One of them that I thought was, one of the ideas I thought was very interesting, and I could see this being true, is they said that what Satan was doing is actually mocking Job's confession. When Job said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will return there," this commentator said that he feels like Satan is now mocking him, which makes sense. Satan is an accuser. He's going to do all he can to mock and accuse, bring charges against. And he says what Satan is saying is that what Job was saying originally was, "I came into this life with nothing. I'm going to leave this life with nothing. But naked I came, I still have my skin. I still have my life. I can endure losing all my material possessions. I can endure losing my children. But just don't take my life, please. Don't take my health away." He's saying that's what Job was really saying. I can deal with this other stuff, but I can't deal with the fact that my physical body might be, my skin might be affected in some way. I could see that being part of it, being part of what was going on here, because Satan, like I said, is an accuser and wants to mock. He's forever challenging the faith of God's people. But God allows then Satan to afflict Job's body. And once again, we see several themes in the way this is phrased. But Satan recognizes once again that it has to be God's work ultimately. And once again, you see this submission that Satan has to God. He says to God, "Put forth your hand now and touch his bone and flesh." Put forth your hand. This is what he's saying. Satan is the messenger, like I said, but ultimately God is the one who sends that affliction. And we also see once again that God puts Job into Satan's hand. Verse 6, the Lord says to Satan, "Behold, he's in your power." Literally, "Behold, he's in your hand. I'm putting him in your hand again." But once again, he's still in God's hands, because God says, "Only spare his life. You can go so far, you can't go further." So Job can afflict, so Satan can afflict Job physically, but God says you cannot kill him. You cannot take his life away. One of the ways that people will sometimes try to comfort someone who's going through a really hard time, you know, if it's, you know, just a real tragedy in the family, or a really, you know, life-threatening disease, sickness of some sort. Sometimes you'll hear, and I think sometimes we're kind of even tempted to say something like this, but sometimes you'll hear, "You need to recognize that God had nothing to do with this." And they'll say that kind of thing mainly because I think they're concerned for the person, that they not get mad at God and somehow stop believing in God. And so, you know, you need to recognize God had nothing to do with this. But there's a big problem with that. First off, it's not true. But also, it doesn't really help like you think it's going to help. Because if God had nothing to do with that, he's not really in control. I mean, he can slip in and get all kinds of things out at you that God just cannot stop. He can't keep that from happening. He's not in charge. So how, if you couldn't trust him then, how can you trust him in the middle of the trial? How can you trust him to kind of look back on it and figure out, what am I going to do with this now? I mean, you're in his hand all the way through. So it's not true to tell someone, or if somebody tells you that, then if you want to correct them, I think that would be a good idea. But if you don't feel comfortable correcting them, just correct it in your own mind. That's not true. It's not true to say God had nothing to do with this. That's not biblical. That's not right. And it's not helpful. Next thing we see is this. Job must now endure excruciating physical pain. Verses 7 through 8 describe for us briefly what Satan brought on to Job. "Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes." Now, it's really impossible to give like an accurate medical diagnosis of exactly what Job's sickness or disease was. Here it says, my version says, sore boils that were literally all of his body from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. There's places later in the book of Job where other symptoms are described, where Job himself, as he's talking about what he's going through, he actually refers to several things that are happening in his body that kind of give us a even a little more detail about what was doing. We're not going to look at all these verses, but I want to mention a few of these symptoms. In chapter 30, verse 17, Job talks about aching and rotting bones. Aching and rotting bones. Later in the same chapter, he talks about dark and peeling skin. One I do want to read is chapter 7, verse 5. It says, my flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. Worms, I think, can also be translated maggots. Some of your versions may say maggots. He apparently had worms, maggots, and the sores. And then his skin would harden, and then the things would burst out again and run again. So those kind of things kind of coming and going. In chapter 10, verse 20, it speaks of something that you might call almost like anorexia or extreme starvation. In 30, verse 30, speaks of a fever. In verse 16 of that chapter, he speaks of depression. In chapter 16, verse 16, he speaks of weeping. Back in chapter 7 again, there's sleeplessness. Could not sleep, could not rest. Also in chapter 7, he said there he had nightmares. In chapter 19, verse 17, there is putrid breath. Now, this is the kind of breath that's going to be fixed with Listerine. Because this is the kind of breath that actually is because of the decay that's happening inside of him. You know, that's, you can smell it on his breath. In 16:16, there's failing vision. In chapter 19, verse 20, he talks about rotting teeth. Job looked so bad, just outwardly, that in chapter 2, verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12, when his three friends come to sit beside him, it says that first off, they didn't even recognize him because he was so distorted, you know, with the disease, the sickness, the boils, all that was going on with him. His body was deteriorating. He was in pain all over, internally, externally, just pain. I think it's also something to recognize, he really had nothing to help him endure the pain. I thought there was an interesting quote by John Calvin. He said, Job went into his trial destitute of many of those firm supports and grounds of consolation which are now so plentifully supplied to suffering saints. He had no medication, nothing even as simple as aspirin or Tylenol. He had no one to wash or bathe his wounds. Nobody put compresses or anything or bandages. You don't see anything. There's nothing. The only thing that's even mentioned is that he's sitting in an ash heap, which probably a couple things there. Maybe it's because it was soft. Also, a lot of people think that was the city dump. And so he'd actually kind of, in a sense, excommunicate himself away from the people in the town. And it says he took pieces of broken pottery and scratched the boils to try to get some sort of relief from what he was dealing with. But that was it. That's all he had to really deal with, the pain. Extreme pain and virtually nothing to help ease it, the pain. He was really suffering. One of the things that Satan may be right about is that, and this may vary from person to person, is that the most difficult trials oftentimes for people to face are the ones that actually are physical trials, where they are actually going through the pain themselves. Now, again, that can vary depending on what the outward circumstances are and other trials might be from person to person. But I think it would be common to understand that obviously it's an extremely difficult trial when you're in that kind of physical suffering and anguish. But even there, we recognize that God intends even the most extreme of circumstances to mold us more completely into the image of Christ, to use them for our good. As a matter of fact, I think something to be good to mention here is that really Job is like a type of the suffering that Christ endured himself. He's a type. I mean, it's not an exact parallel at all. But there is at least one similarity. Well, more than one. I'm just the extreme suffering is there. But the main similarity is that the point that's been made is that Job suffered for nothing he did wrong. There was nothing he had done wrong to precipitate, to cause the suffering he went through. Or the suffering that Jesus Christ endured also, he did nothing wrong. He was perfectly righteous. He was perfectly holy. The suffering he endured was on behalf of his church. It reminds us of the fact that he was perfect. He was holy. He was an unblemished lamb. And he didn't suffer on the cross for any sin of his own. He died as a substitute. He died for our sins on the cross. He died for Job's sins, too. Job did have sins. He was not suffering because of his sins, but that doesn't mean he was sinless. And so Christ also suffered for Job's sins. We all need Christ to suffer and die for our sins so our sin can be forgiven and we can be made right with God. So there is, I think, a type, there's a connection here with the suffering that Jesus Christ endured many centuries after this. Now, let's look now at how Job reacted to the second test. Number two, Job perseveres in his faith through, actually probably better to say in spite of there, but in spite of his physical pain and the foolish counsel of his wife. Verses 9 and 10. His wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Now we can see just in this brief conversation with his wife that yes, Job indeed did hold fast his integrity. I mean, he's got that testimony from his wife there that he is holding fast once again to his integrity, even with this second trial. He continued to trust God. But in the midst of this confession, we see another aspect of the second test, and it really comes through his wife. She's really the forgotten sufferer in this story. We need to remember that all the sheep, the camel, the oxen, the donkeys, I mean, they belonged to her just as much as they belonged to Job. They were hers too. The servants served her as much as serving Job. The children were hers as much as they were Job's children. She was the mom. So, obviously, she endured this first test at least as much as Job endured that first test, maybe even more so, just with the heart of a mother being thrown in there. We don't know how she responded to that first test. She's not mentioned. But it's obvious that she was spared from the second test. The Lord, if you remember, the Lord did not make her off limits. It had to do with Job. But Satan chose not to afflict Job's wife. And it seems by her words to Job that Satan had other plans in mind for Mrs. Job in this situation. Now, anybody, you don't have to think very much to understand the pressure and the stress that she would be under. The agony that she was enduring as well. But in spite of that, we still have to recognize this next reality. Next point, Job's wife, in the midst of great suffering herself, became a mouthpiece for Satan. She actually became a mouthpiece for Satan. First, she says, "Do you still hold fast your integrity?" Kind of have a sense that was probably not said in an encouraging way. You know, "You still hold fast your integrity after all this?" You remember, the Lord had boasted to Satan about Job being a blameless, upright man, fearing God, turning away from evil, holding fast his integrity. Exact phrase that God used. Satan was convinced, if you remember, that Job would not hold fast that integrity if God took away these material blessings, his family, and physical health. So now, if you can kind of imagine yourself as Satan, and you're observing now the aftermath of Job being afflicted, I think one of the first things that Satan's going to be thinking is, you still holding fast your integrity now? You still holding fast that integrity? He doesn't expect it to happen. He doesn't want it to happen. What would be the next thing that Satan would be wanting to communicate to Job? I think it would be, curse God and die, Job. Curse God. He's already said that was his purpose. To take, you know, for God to let the hedge down so that he could bring these kind of afflictions into his life so that Job would curse God. Those are the words of Satan. And they're coming from his wife now. Now, what do you think, and we don't know this, but what do you think her motivation would be in saying those things? Well, we can imagine a number of things that would be very natural to imagine. I mean, it could be agitation. I mean, she probably heard Job. She was probably around when Job said, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And she's thinking, that's my kid you're talking about. Don't you think that's kind of trite? Just to say, Lord gave, Lord took away. I mean, I could maybe sense some agitation there about that. She could be mad at God. I mean, I think she probably recognizes the sovereignty of God in the same sense that Job did. It could be that she just sees no other way out for Job. I mean, it's interesting. The word for curse in curse God can also be translated, believe it or not, bless God. Some of your Bibles might have that in the margin. That word can go either way. It can mean bless or it can mean curse. It depends on the context on which one it's supposed to be. So the translation could be her saying in a sarcastic way, keep on blessing God. Keep on dying. Some people say she's trying to encourage you to commit suicide. I guess that's a possibility. I don't think that's what it would be. I think it's more like if you curse God, he's going to kill you because you cursed him. But here it could be saying, what good is it to bless God? Keep blessing God. You're going to die anyway. Look at what's happening to you now. And you bless God. So I don't know exactly what she had in mind when she said that. But what I don't think she had in mind was being a mouthpiece for Satan. I really don't think that's what she was thinking at all. But that's what she became. And I believe that was part of Satan's plan. Look at this quote by Matthew Henry. He says, it's Satan's policy to send his temptations by the hand of those that are dear to us, as he tempted Adam by Eve and Christ by Peter. That's one of his techniques. It's to bring temptations to us through people that we care about greatly. Sometimes he uses us to bring those temptations to them. One thing I think it tells us, we need to be really careful what we say to each other when, you know, when these difficult things are happening, we're trying to work through it. Because unintentionally, we can become a mouthpiece of Satan. Maybe not with bad motives, but we could actually end up giving counsel that's more consistent with what Satan would counsel than what the Word of God would counsel. Maybe because you feel sorry for him and you think, I don't want to say that, you know, that will sound mean. We just have to be careful of that, because that is one of Satan's tools that he uses, is to use people, the closest ones to us, to oftentimes bring some of the most difficult temptations to us. But Job did hold fast his integrity, and he did not curse God. Well, how was he able to do that? Well, that's our last point. Job endured his trials through a foundational trust in his sovereign God. I use the word foundational because I think this is what he built on. I mean, it was a firm, it was a solid foundation, this confidence that he had in God. Once again, verse 10. He said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" And all this Job did not sin with his lips. First of all, I think it's important to note that he does not reject his wife. And he doesn't call her a fool. As a matter of fact, I think the way it's worded, the assumption is that she's not a fool. The assumption is that she too would be a woman who fears God. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And so the assumption here, I think, as I would read this, that was the normal characterization of her. But in this situation, she is speaking as a foolish woman would speak. She's not a fool. He's not calling her a fool, but he says, in this particular situation, you're speaking like a foolish woman. That's not what you are. But you're talking like that now. The situation. But she was talking as that. It was out of character, you could say. But still, she said it. The counsel she was giving was foolish counsel. And then he gives the reason for why this is foolish counsel. This one thing that's remarkable to me, that Job could be going through all of this, and he still understands these basic truths enough to be able to verbalize it. He probably doesn't feel real close to God right now. But you're going to tell as we go through the book of Job, he doesn't feel real lovey-dovey and close to God. But he knows what's true. And he stands on what is true, regardless of what he feels, physically or emotionally or spiritually, whatever. He says, "Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" Now, I think the contrast between Job and his wife here shows us something else important for us to take note of, quote by John Riesinger. He says, in Job's response to his wife, we have a picture of the horrible weakness of a faith that goes by sight and the amazing strength of a faith that sees the sovereign hand of God in all things. Job's wife is totally thrown off by what she has personally seen and experienced. She is just thrown off what she would normally believe and how she would normally act. She sees the bad things that have happened and really thinks it's not worth serving God anymore.